all the previous cases that I've been involved with, where the situation is like this here, it's always been a recovery. It's never been a
please God,
happy ending.
Bring her home.
You will start to question whether a memory is real or false only when that element of memory or that.
Why did his father leave him in a ditch in the middle of nowhere, then lie about it and disappear?
From eye scrapings and evasive nose probings to incisions in the skin, John of God has performed countless unlicensed surgical procedures, seemingly with no anesthesia, on enraptured followers.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners, part 4 of John of God, the final episode we will have to spend with him, but likely the most horrific. Included in this episode will be clips from an interview I did a few weeks ago with Esther Flores, who has been described as a woman you want on your side, and as a woman who helps to spread love in the trenches. In a Columbia Free Press article written by Reverend Gary Witt, he states that, quote, Esther Flores is a fighter. She champions for the rights and dignity of all people, and she fights against bigotry and prejudice. You want Esther on your side. A registered nurse, Esther has created and developed a program, One Divine Line to Health, which provides vital services, healthcare to those women caught up in sex trafficking in Columbus, and especially on the infamous Sullivan Avenue on the west side. She has also set up several safe houses within the Columbus area for women in recovery. She was raised in New York, and she is a woman of strong faith and character, and she teaches us that we can change our attitudes about trafficked women by calling them what they are, street sisters, who deserve our care and understanding. One can see her red minivan driving around attending to her sisters on the west side, end quote. So when I spoke to her, she called that van the love bug and has risked her life many times confronting people actively harming these girls. No joke, like gun to her head more than once. But she's not just an advocate and helper for trafficked victims in the Ohio area. She got into this when traveling abroad as a nurse and witnessing the horrors of trafficking and abuse of the vulnerable, children, people stricken with poverty, people desperate to escape their situation, that are preyed upon by people like John of God, who know how to sniff out that desperation. What breaks my heart is that John of God grew up in poverty. Like, would he have wanted to be exploited? No. He learned how to be the exploiter, the con artist, the rapist, and the harvester of babies for money. Money, money, money. So when you think of John of God as a healer, a psychic surgeon, a miracle worker, think again. This man isn't nothing but a Jeffrey Epstein counterpart. Actually, if it's possible, I think he's worse. The first parts of this episode will contain the last of the despicable crimes John of God is alleged to have committed, although there could be way more. And then you will hear from a woman who had boots on the ground for decades, helping victims abroad and at home, that's Esther Flores, who I mentioned. She helped them to survive and to thrive away from the grips of people like John of God. But before we get to the crime, I just wanted to thank new patrons, Hannah and Sam, this week. And just so you know, for the Patreon and for future Seven Deadly Sinners content, except for it's a sister podcast, Deadly Diocese, I just got back from Buffalo, New York last night, and holy shit. Deadly Diocese, like I said, coming out in spring 2022, is mind-blowingly more than I could have imagined. I don't know if mind-blowingly is a word, and I don't know that I care, because that's how I feel about it. I mean, that trip, we were there for just over a week, and the murder victim's family and friends became our family after this trip. I'm not joking. And then there was an incredible amount of serendipitous interviews we got from people who loved him in moments we were not expecting. And then Maybe those things were only perhaps overshadowed by the deep corruption in that diocese that we didn't only feel we were not welcome because we were locked out of churches, they slammed doors in our faces, they ran away from us. But I've never felt so strongly that justice needs to be served. It's going to take a lot of grit that I'm confident I'm too invested not to find that grit. Like a very Clint Eastwood. What am I talking about? John Wayne? Leave me alone. But we're in deep. Greg, myself, and our original Buffalo contact, who has now become a lifetime friend, Joe. I'm confident we aren't giving up. And we won't be scared away. And justice is coming for the many victims and our brave whistleblower, who sadly had to die for this story to be told. Father Moreno, please guide us. Okay, now for the last part, for now at least, on the crimes of John of God.
He grabbed my hand and he moved it behind me on his pants. And I was like, why do I have to touch your He took it a step further. He penetrated me from behind. I can't even describe it.
Child trafficking, receiving large sums of money and also gifts as payment.
Women were used as sex slaves. They were usually black, low income, and lived close to John of God's illegal properties. In return for food, they were impregnated and the babies sold off to the UK, Australia, and US. The girls were aged between 14 and 18.
Well, on Saturday, it was reported that Sabrina there had committed suicide, citing threats from John of God's followers, but also her long struggle with cancer. Another whistleblower, Amy Bianc, was among the first to publicly speak out. She's an American who was working as a tour guide in Brazil and used to advertise John of God's spiritual centre as a tourist attraction. She shared with RT some disturbing details of what she allegedly saw happening there.
So really, if you thought the story of John of God couldn't get any worse, you're sadly mistaken. It's kind of starting to sound like a work of fiction to me, but the hits just keep coming. And I gotta tell you, I believe them. When we last saw the psychic healer, he was a fugitive evading police after being chased from the Casa by a storm of media. And if you'll remember, police searched more than 20 properties owned by the medium to no avail. John was nowhere to be found. John had withdrawn nearly $8.9 million from multiple bank accounts several days before he reached fugitive status, convincing authorities that he could be planning to flee the country or hide the money, perhaps in an offshore account. The arrest warrant was issued a couple of days later on Friday, and John of God finally surrendered to police on Sunday, December 16th, 2018. A cell phone video shows John of God getting out of a vehicle and surrendering to police on a desolate dirt road in Abadania. In the video, which broadcast on Brazil's Globo TV, he can be heard saying, quote, "I surrendered to divine justice and, as promised, I now place myself in the hands of earthly justice." And his old pals like Oprah Winfrey, Dr. Oz. After the arrest, they wiped their websites and video clips of any scent of their time with the medium clean. And Oprah said in a statement, quote, "I empathize with the women now coming forward, and I hope justice is served," end quote. Lead investigator Paul Miotti issued search warrants for the medium's various properties, even though he was already in jail. The properties shown in the Netflix documentary were untidy spaces. It was clear John of God was a hoarder and was very fond of his earthly possessions. As police swarmed his various compounds, they weren't necessarily surprised with what they found. One investigator said they uncovered false bottoms in nearly every drawer of his homes, and a hidden panic room only accessible by someone forcing an elevator to go down. though it only displayed buttons for the floors above. That's so creepy. In the basement of one of the rooms, down a set of rickety stairs, through a trap door in the floor, was a safe. After forcing it open with a circular saw, police uncovered gobs of money, 6 illegally owned guns, 1 with the serial number sawed off, and nearly 100 pieces of jewelry made of precious stones, presumably from the mines he owned. In total, about 50 million reais, which when I did the math, is the equivalent today of more than $8.7 million. Holy shit. I should also mention at this point that John's wife, Anna, risked being indicted as an accomplice in the crimes of illegal gun ownership and money laundering, though in all of my research, I can't find any evidence that she served any time in jail. But let's just stop for a second. He had a wife during all of this? 600 plus alleged sexual assaults? Sinister trafficking claims? I mean, ma'am, come on. It's a hard pill to swallow to think that you knew nothing. Anna, what'd you know? And then Brazilian reporter Sara Teofilo interviewed people in the city of Abundância about the accusations against John of God, most of whom claimed the charges were all based on lies or who said they'd rather be quiet because he was too powerful. What's so sad is that the people of this town had to rely on the shady business and criminal activity of John of God to survive. To me, it makes sense, though, that they would want to support him. He was how they supported their families. These things aren't as black and white as we want to believe. Of course, John of God is a piece of shit who raped and abused hundreds of women, which pisses me off and breaks my heart, and he probably shook every business in this town down for percentages and cash, but to them, it seemed like he was their only option. And that's what abusers and con artists do. They prey on your weakness and corner you in your desperation. Unsurprisingly, the town of Abundância had turned into a ghost town. Boarded up shops and hostels, empty parking lots. Many of the hostels and inns in the town had been fully booked through 2023, prior to John of God's arrest. And people used to fight over vacancies. Can you imagine? But John of God's face was still on all the taxis. Signs hung in the windows of abandoned buildings and the shops that were still open that said, quote, approved by the entity. John of God seemed to have had control of the entire town. In the meantime, John's power over the community and reach worldwide began to wane. Fewer and fewer people were showing up at the CASA for treatment, down from thousands a day to just handfuls. Faithful volunteers still carried on the work of the medium, giving of their time to perform healing ceremonies. The devoted. Oh, so devoted. It's cult-like. I find a judgment against John of God from back in 2013, though, quite telling in how it relates to his relationship with the greater Abundância community, how far-reaching his intimidation might have been. A 16-year-old girl at that time had claimed to be abused by the spiritual healer when she and her father entered his private quarters. And trigger warning. This includes... But the whole episode has included depictions of sexual assault, but this one's going to piss you off a lot. John ordered both of them to close their eyes and her father to turn his back to them, his eyes remaining closed. There, John of God physically assaulted her. According to Brazil's Court of Appeals website, as seen in the Netflix documentary, the judgment stated that John of God, after ordering the 16-year-old girl and her father in the same room to close their eyes, he, quote,
watch a 16-year-old girl claim to be abused by him. She got in his room with her father, and he ordered both of them to close their eyes. And he caressed her breast, belly, bottom, and crotch. A 16-year-old girl, then. He asked her father to turn his back on them and never open his eyes. The judge said, although we can say the victim was vulnerable because of her panic syndrome condition, it does not explain why she did not react against the grim actions of the defendant, because she was not alone in the room. The acts of the defendant, when disregarding the ethical principles that guide the doctrine of Allan Kardec, were immoral, but do not characterize sexual violation by means of fraud for the absence of essential elements.
This is only one example of this evil man getting away with the crime in court. Did he have some power over this judge? Leverage? As the trial began in 2019, video shows the disgraced spiritual leader slowly shuffling into the interrogation room, dressed in his usual white garb. The media circus following him around every corner. The number of uniformed, armed police seemingly matched the number of media personnel. What did they think the feeble old man was going to do? Run away? I mean, he's probably capable of it. Probably got some henchmen that can just pick him up out of there. Stranger things have happened in these types of scenarios. But video also shows brave victims walking through their testimonies together, which is a beautiful thing to see. They do this through tears and trembling voices, but they are together.
I decided to give my testimony today because the consequences of a crime committed years ago still haunt me. Migraines caused by emotions, the destruction of my femininity because of a trauma I could never overcome, are some of the marks I've been carrying. He stole part of my life, my joy. Part of my happiness, my freedom, and my dignity. But he did not kill me. I've learned how to live with that pain, but not how to heal it. Since then, all I can think of is how I can bring justice and send him where he belongs, jail.
That was Andrea rehearsing her carefully crafted statement in front of her team of prosecutors. And you might remember Andrea as the badass from last episode who called John out in his private quarters, calling him a pig. And I freaking loved it. John maintained his innocence, though, denying every accusation, and said he never knew any of the victims. He gave no signs of regret or remorse, and his defense team suggested house arrest with electronic surveillance because John was allegedly terrified of his dark cell, and he kept falling out of his bed. His cellmate kindly moved his mattress to the floor next to John's bed, just in case, and said John was crazy distressed, though his medical evaluation at the maximum security prison stated he was in good health. A year after he surrendered to police, John was convicted of 4 rapes and sentenced to 19 years. A month after his first conviction, he was found guilty of 5 more rapes and sentenced to an additional 40 years. He was also convicted of a firearms charge. On January 20th, 2020, the spiritual healer received his 3rd and final sentence, so far that is, totaling 63 years and 4 months in prison for the rape of 4 women. Naturally, John's lawyers called it a case of injustice and requested his release at home with 24-hour surveillance due to his age. They doubled down on the request once COVID started wreaking havoc on the country of Brazil, putting him at risk of death. The court agreed to let the sexual abuser serve the rest of his term from home. In total, he only spent 1 year and 4 months in jail. Today, there are multiple lawsuits filed against him and dozens of women who are still waiting for their own date in court regarding their own cases against the medium. But John? Nah. He's living his best life in one of his many homes, feasting on meals that I'm assuming were not prepared by his own two hands. The Netflix documentary doesn't get into this, but I wonder if he is still performing cleansing rituals in his home. I would certainly hope not, but at the same time, I wouldn't put it past him. Meanwhile, his victims are livid, and rightly so, over his release to house arrest. They were, in a sense, themselves also on house arrest due to the stay-at-home orders in light of the pandemic. So how is this any different from their abuser's punishment? They were also imprisoned in their anguish. It just wasn't fair. They were the ones living with the nightmares, the panic attacks, migraines, weight gain, PTSD. The only difference, it seemed, was the lack of an ankle monitor. Quote, "The trauma doesn't end," said one of the victim's attorneys. She keeps revisiting the trauma over and over. And there are a great number of people who say, "I've never been the same again. He ruined my life. I can't be in a relationship. I'm still on psychological support 15, 20 years later." One of John of God's victims explained how the anxiety and trauma manifested within her body.
"I really did turn into another person. 2 years after what happened in Abadiânia, I weighed almost 220 pounds. I went from 135 to 220 pounds. I had diabetes, muscle aches, hip pain. I was completely ill. I was so hidden inside myself that I couldn't recognize me anymore. When I met people, it was absurd. I told myself, this is not me. I'm not like this. And this led to serious psychological and psychosomatic issues in my personal life, but especially in my professional life. And still, up to this day, I can't see myself. I can't see the Regine I used to be, light, free. There is a Regine before Abadiânia and the Regine now."
That makes me so sad. Her abuse occurred in 2010 and she is still dealing with the repercussions more than a decade later. And yet, in spite of all the allegations and ultimate sentencing, John said, quote, "I truly believe in the authorities. I put my life in the authorities' hands. I put my life in God's hands. I am conscious that God will help me," end quote. I hope so, dude. Actually, I really don't hope so. I really hope that that kind of backfires on you, scumbag. Anyway, you might think we are close to wrapping this story up. Like, what other crazy sins could this man have possibly committed? Now for the worst of the worst. Although the other ones were incredibly bad too. Okay, trigger warning. Activist Sabrina Bittencourt accused the medium of running a 2-decade-long human trafficking operation that sold babies to families in the US, Australia, and European countries for up to $50,000. According to the Columbia Journalism Review, Sabrina was a sexual assault survivor herself. Her childhood marked by physical, psychological, and sexual violence as early as the age of 4 by 2 members of her family. Sabrina grew up a member of the Mormon community and was raped by a stranger at the age of 16 and then suffered a miscarriage. She married her first husband, a recently converted Mormon, at the age of 20, and then also suffered abuse at his hand. She divorced him 4 months later while pregnant with her first child. Perhaps because of these tenacious early years, she became the founder of a movement dedicated to reporting instances of abuse by religious leaders, and had gathered hundreds of testimonies from victims against John of God. She said, quote, "I overcame all of this by creating social projects and businesses, traveling a lot and seeing the world and situations worse than mine. This stopped me from becoming a victim. I went head on in the pursuit of helping those people who, like me, suffered abuse within a religious institution. I believe in a social justice in which society as a whole can protect people's lives and diminish the power of those who use faith to abuse by exposing them publicly in a responsible way." End quote. She often fed information to journalists. Her face was featured on the cover of a national magazine as the woman who brought down John of God. But then, death threats had followed. Sadly, on a Sunday in early February of 2019, it is said that the 38-year-old activist committed suicide. She had been, quote, living under protection in Spain after receiving threats to her life. Many close to Sabrina don't believe the story of suicide. Her first husband has said he suspects she is with her son in an unknown location. Other family members provided evidence of their unsuccessful attempts to obtain reliable information about her death. I wonder if someone made good on their death threats. Apparently, she left a suicide note. The eldest of her three sons, Gabriel, confirmed her death on Facebook, writing, quote, "She took the last step so that we could live. They killed my mother." Sabrina was instrumental in John of God's arrest in December of 2018. The following year, she began to make claims that children were being, quote, farmed in Brazil before being sold to childless couples around the world. Even the New York Post and Daily Mail reported these claims. She also added that the women were murdered after 10 years of giving birth. In a video, Sabrina states that she has spoken to women from at least three continents who claim to have purchased Brazilian babies from the entity for tens of thousands of dollars. Allegedly, John would offer money to poor girls anywhere from age 14 to 18 to go live in mineral mines or other farms he owned. There, they would become sex slaves and the babies from their forced pregnancies would be sold to the highest bidder. It's very Handmaid's Tale of him. The Daily Mail discussed these allegations in an episode from March of 2019. Here's a clip.
Since then, the disgraced guru has also been accused of running baby farms where girls were raped, impregnated, and then murdered 10 years after giving birth. Their infants allegedly sold on the black market. Faria remains behind bars and will face trial on rape and sexual abuse charges.
According to the New York Post, quote, "In exchange for food, they were impregnated and their babies sold on the black market," Sabrina said. Quote, "Hundreds of girls were enslaved over years, lived on farms and guayas, and served as wombs to get pregnant for their babies to be sold. These girls were murdered after 10 years of giving birth. We've got a number of testimonies. We have received reports from adoptive mothers of their children that we sold for between $20,000 to $50,000 in Europe, USA, and Australia, as well as testimony from ex-workers and local people who are tired of being complicit," end quote. TV journalist and American legal counsel Nancy Grace offered her opinion on the charges John could be facing regarding the sex farm allegations and what evidence prosecutors needed to be looking for to prove their case in the Daily Mail interview.
Well, I'm sure he has denied all of these claims. If these claims are true, that he sex assaulted young teen girls, took babies from them, and farmed them out for adoption fees, those children will bear his DNA. And that's pretty incriminating evidence, if it exists.
Sabrina also claimed the testimonies she collected from former members of his gang described how the whole wretched scheme worked after they grew a conscience in relation to his crimes. But now that she's dead, allegedly, I hope she's not, but I'm sure we will never see this evidence. It seems as though at least this part of the case is still at a standstill. But what kind of helped me to understand this whole world, because his whole baby farm crimes are still up in the air and they may never get prosecuted. But I spoke to a victim's advocate who I mentioned at the top of this episode, Esther Flores, who knows the whole gamut of the sex trafficking, human trafficking, organ harvesting, maybe even baby harvesting. I put a call into her as I was putting this episode together because I had planned to just use her interview for another case I was going to do. But as I was writing the end of this, I was like, she's kind of talking about what this guy did. And I wanted to give you guys a snippet of a person who works boots on the ground. Just, she does this all day long, all night long. Again, gun to her head sometimes. She might give us some insight into how prevalent this can be and why it's possible John of God was selling babies to Western countries and beyond. Here is Esther Flores.
I would like you to do most of the talking, but I will prompt you with questions.
That's all I need. Just guide me, ask me the questions, and I'll do my best to answer them because that helps me.
Good. Okay. Well, I know that you're good at, you're entertaining and you're good at talking and you're, yeah, I sensed that from the first phone call we had, so I'm not worried about it. So how did you get, what prompted you to start your organization? And it's One Divine Line to Health, right?
Absolutely. I have been a nurse for 20 plus years. I feel kind of old right now. It's been a while. And when I had money, when I was working as an RN, I was able to take a few weeks during the year and travel abroad in medical missions, different villages. And what was interesting about it was that I saw that many people were dying for from curable diseases here, infections that if they had the antibiotics or they had the equipment, especially the physicians, these folks would survive. So I just thought maybe I should start a nonprofit whereby we can have Columbus doctors go abroad with me, and we can provide the medical supplies and donate it to like national hospitals and have fun. Well, it turns out that within a year of doing that, which was a collaborative effort, by the way, of other nonprofits, local hospitals here, and clinics, they loved the idea because most of the time the equipment, the medical supplies, they were considered contaminated and they were not used. They would actually end up in a garbage dump or in a landfill. So after doing this for about a year and a half, I came back from one of the countries and I did a little presentation and I was talking about human trafficking because I was being exposed to children who were trafficked abroad.
How obvious was it? Like, how did you know for sure that that's what was going on?
Because I was volunteering with my skills and I had already developed rapport with the local hospitals. And you got to understand that most of the countries that I visited were socialists. So these are national hospitals. So you would have one hospital that would treat the whole country, which is unbelievable. Like in Guatemala. Let me use that as an example.
Wow.
So people would travel 8, 10, 12, 14, maybe even 24 hours just to get there. We're talking about not people flying because people don't have the money. They would, you know, cross rivers through boats, and it was just a very sad situation. At the hospital, I befriended some of the physicians, and they taught me a lot, and they liked the fact that I was an American doctor, I mean, an American nurse. So they exposed me to their nursing and the medical procedures. You know, I used to be an OR nurse, so I participated in some of the surgeries because they taught me, and I knew a little bit more than their nurses. And what was interesting about it is that I got exposed to kids that were coming to the hospital sexually abused, you know, kids who were violated, who were raped, including women. And what really broke my heart was that it was a responsibility. Like, for example, if a child was kidnapped and was raped or was trafficked, it was the responsibility of the family, if the child had a family, to find the perpetrator. You see the injustice there? And was overwhelming. And many times I got to see how, at least here, there are protocols, because I used to work at Nationwide, well, now it's called Nationwide Children's Hospital. The physicians don't re-victimize or re-traumatize the child. Their protocols are established over there. The child would have to tell the story over and over again. And also, the assessment, which involved them looking at their private areas, at the genitalia, and you imagine if a child was violated or a woman was violated, they would have to be reassessed a couple of times. That is, like, unacceptable.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, re-traumatizing, re-violating.
Okay, this is how obsessed I am with Thrive Cosmetics.
Yes, and you see, like, in my nature, being involved in this organization, I've seen a lot. And what really upsets me is that our kids go missing, and we're talking about, like, colored children, like Mexican girls, mm-hmm. Including our women, or just African-American kids, all right? We already know that the price tag on children on the streets, it's very costly, okay? They're going to make money, okay? The pimp is going to make money.
I ask you what, yeah. Do you know what you're educating me right now. What yeah. is the, is there like a standard price? And,
I couldn't imagine. No, it's not. Because, like, for example, our women, they charge between $20 to about maybe $40, you know, for a sexual encounter, depending if mm-hmm. it's a oral sex or regular type of sex. Or the more freaky it is, or the more of a fetish, it's going to cost more. Okay.
Oh, okay.
So that's the adult price. So a child would probably, just having a sexual encounter with the child, it could cost more than $100 to $300 a session, depending, again, what they're doing with the child. This is why you got men. It's mostly men who are involved in child porn. We've had situations here locally. We've had judges. We've had cops. We've had teachers involved in the situation, which is really, it's a concern that you got people who are interested in hurting our children. So in response to our kids who go missing, the problem that I have here in Ohio is that a mom, you know, sees her 11-year-old. These are experiences that I've had. Again, mm-hmm. I'm not making this up. No.
Yeah,
but this is sad, because the reason why I'm talking to you about the children is the fact that over here, I call it children, which means, you know, we're talking about any colored child, from Hispanics mm-hmm. to African-American or biracial kids. What happens is a parent may go to the police department and say, hey, my child is missing. Most of the times, okay, it's pretty high. It's usually a friend or a relative that will kidnap this child, okay? We had a situation mm-hmm. that a young girl was actually taken from Columbus into to Mexico, okay, across the border, All right? So you already know that our rules don't apply in foreign territory. It doesn't, okay? So, and there's so much red tape when it comes to the FBI being involved, even foreign and locally. So these are the things that really upsets me, because at times there was another situation where a young
I've never done this before.
Because they do this because of the paperwork, okay? They don't want to go through the protocols, okay? And this is what happens. Everybody knows if a child is missing, you know, within 12 hours, that child, okay, even 24, the longer that that kid is missing, they can be a victimized. They can be a victim of human trafficking 100%. Because they are vulnerable, all right? And this is what really upsets me here, because a lot of the situations that I'm right now, I work with adults who most of them were kidnapped. They are from other states. They're also—
Were they kidnapped, you know, as children or as adults?
Yes, kidnapped as children from other states. We have people here from Chicago, you know, from California, from Alabama, from Texas, and it makes me really concerned, because I'm only trying to have in our city more drop-in centers, especially in the epicenters, you know, like I had talked to you about, you know, where there's a lot of drug trafficking and human trafficking. Like, our city is just such a lagger. You know, if you go to New York and you go to Texas, you go to Florida, I mean, I've been to, like, New York, obviously I'm a native New Yorker, and I've been to the drop-in center, and they're in hot zones, and I'm like, you give people an opportunity to be embraced with love, you know, and you link them to resources, and eventually what happens is, you know, love overpowers the evil that they're so used to. You know, they are, they have no self-worth. They're used to somebody beating them up. They're used to somebody making the decision. And you imagine a child could be easily manipulated, and people like myself who are trauma-informed and trauma-responsive, we know how the brain works, okay? So it is through manipulation or coercion or through force that these beautiful, broken souls are controlled, and it is amazing that they are resilient. And they need people like myself to embrace them and tell them, you know what, you can do this. You want to get out of here? I can help you right now. But a lot of time, which
can
is
I work
so
with you? I want to go and help. I mean, I don't live in Ohio, but, like, I get your passion for it. Like, is that what made you get into it? Is, like, you saw that and you were just like, I got to do something.
But you see, this is why we have to educate, and I think we need to be real about this. And what you also have to understand, I'm a woman, and as a woman, I'm able to go to places that no one goes to. And the fact that I've been doing this for 5.5 years, I enter the places, like I go into the dope houses, the trap houses, abandoned dominiums. Huh?
I said, fuck, I'd go.
Yeah, no, but you know what? You can't, not anybody can go, because you have to be trusted or they'll kill you. You know, it's pretty dangerous.
Well, I take a lot of risks with, like, if I,
no,
but
I know,
but I might be stupid in that way in terms of,
but, yeah. Yeah, but it's really complicated. And the problem that I have here is that when you have somebody like myself, who's not only a professional, people know that I have veracity. All right. That's part of one of my—
You have
code
what?
Of
veracity?
Yeah, veracity. I speak truth. Okay.
Yeah.
It's one of my code of ethics as a registered nurse. Okay. I got to speak the truth. And my second code of ethics says that I need to advocate for vulnerable individuals. You hear that? And vulnerable populations. So who am I stuck with? I'm stuck with women, trans women, the children, women, immigrants. Like, that's another situation that we have here. We have women who are involved in domestic violence situations. They speak, you know, they don't speak English, and then they're violated. I mean, like, this year I had to take a couple of them to the hospital, and I'm like, this is like total insanity. You know, we opened the first full-time drop-in center, and next thing you know, I ended up with all these cases, including, we had 15 cases, and I'm actually writing about this on my grant, is that we had 15 unreported rapes. You listen to that? 15 unreported rapes, and they came to the drop-in center, and we were there to serve them. They didn't want me to take them to the hospital. They did not want me to call CPD because we got cops in our city that violate our women, that exchange sex for freedom. And sometimes they don't even care. They still lock them up. You see, this is a situation. A lot of people are guessing what the numbers are. I don't guess. Listen, why? This is direct contact, okay? I got names. What I usually do is at the end of the year, after I count, you know, all the numbers, I burn, you hear that, my logs, because I love these beautiful souls. A lot of them have warrants. A lot of them, you know, are afraid. So if anybody tries to break into my stuff, you know, they're not going to find anything. Because I feel that at this point, I've earned my badge of respect and of honor in this population, and I will do anything, including if I have to die for them. Because they know I've challenged cops, and they've seen my fury. I've challenged some of the thugs, some of the dope dealers. You know, I met my mortality this year, so this is the first time, and this was at gunpoint. You know, someone actually pointed a gun at me with a laser, and I said at that moment, yes, this happened in the summer, and it was a beautiful girl in one of the corners in Franklinton, which is what we call the bottoms on the west side, and it was two dirtbags, two African-American, and they wanted to kidnap her. She was very beautiful. She was young. You know, she was petite, and I got a point.
Was she already involved? It doesn't matter in terms of like.
No, she was a street. Yeah, she was a sex worker. And what happens is when she sees the love bug, she approached us because we feed them, we clothe them, we give them Narcan, you know. And I had one of the volunteers with me. So this guy had said some derogatory terms to her. And I'm like, excuse me. Well, I went ahead and I said, WTF. and I said, as long
you can say what the fuck on my podcast.
Okay, can I say it? Okay, so I said to him, what the fuck are you doing? Or what you're saying? This is a beautiful soul here, and as long as I'm around here, you're gonna treat her with utmost respect. So he cussed me out, and I looked at him, and I said to my volunteer, and I said to the girl, her name, by the way, is Sarah. And there's many Sarahs out there. And I said, Sarah, let me tell you something. I'm ready to meet my maker, but my maker is not ready to meet me yet, because what just happened right now, it's unbelievable. I was in shock. We went ahead and we did our thing because the guy went ahead and drove fast. And, you know, because we were in a secluded alley. And that's the problem, because on the west side, we have so many alleys, and these are areas that our women get violated, they get killed, and it really bothers me. So you imagine, I'm a woman, you know, our volunteers are mostly women, and things are going to be changing.
I know it's a lot, but hey, we're in this together, and I just wanted to say happy holidays, and we got a fun episode for you next week, or a kind of weird, funky one, whatever, you'll see. And then we'll be taking time off until the first of the year. And I recorded that interview with my friend that I did not know was friends with a murderer in a very famous case going on right now. So that's what you're going to expect at the top of the year. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you guys so much. I love you. And if you're enjoying the show, tell a friend. And please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And yeah, until next time.